A new wave of protests and strikes hits France over the planned pension reforms as the UK is bracing for more industrial actions over pay. NATO countries remain divided over the supply of fighter jets to Ukraine days after they announced combat tank deliveries to Kyiv. And some 120 Palestinian prisoners go on hunger strike for a second consecutive day, protesting their inhumane conditions at an Israeli jail. This is World News from Tehran. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, beginning with our top story, in France, police have clashed with protesters in the capital, Paris, and the city of Rennes as workers stage a second day of nationwide rallies and strikes against pension reform backed by President Emmanuel Macron. Police tried to disperse the crowds using tear gas and water cannon. Hundreds of thousands took to the streets in several cities in protests against the government's contested reform plan. A police source saying that they were expecting over 1 million protesters across the nation. The strikes have disrupted transport and schools, among other sectors, and this is the second strike in France over the issue in less than 2 weeks. Workers are against the government's bill that intends to overhaul the pension system and raise retirement age from 62 to 64. Now, elsewhere in Europe, in the UK, firefighters have joined a long list of workers to vote for a nationwide strike over a pay dispute with the government. The Fire Brigades Union says it's given the government 10 days to come up with an improved offer after rejecting a 5% pay rise in November. Any walkout would be the first by firefighters over the pay since 2003. Meanwhile, thousands of ambulance workers would stage fresh strikes on February 10th over similar disputes. They would be joining other trade unions that have planned to stage several walkouts in February and March. Britain's facing its biggest wave of industrial actions in decades, affecting sectors ranging from healthcare, railways to energy and academia. The strikers demand better pay in line with double-digit inflation that has squeezed household budgets. Now, in the middle of all this, the British Prime Minister is yet to find a replacement for chairman of his ruling Conservative Party. Nadeem Zahawi was fired following weeks of revelations about his tax affairs. From London, Saeed Puruza has the story.
Nadeem Zahawi, the Conservative Party chairman, fallen from grace for not paying his taxes. He received accolades as vaccine minister during the pandemic and even ran for prime minister last year. His downfall began after it emerged he settled nearly a $6 million dispute with the UK's tax collector, HMRC, during his time as Chancellor last summer. An inquiry ordered by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak found Zahawi had breached the ministerial code.
Zahawi is out, but now the focus has shifted to the Prime Minister himself. This week, he'll be facing tough questions in the building behind me about how much he knew about Mr. Zahawi's tax affairs and when.
Zahawi's sacking has also acted as a reminder about Rishi Sunak's reinstatement of Suella Braverman as Home Secretary last year, after she resigned for breaching the ministerial code by sending a sensitive official document from her personal email account.
Sunak has said he wanted to have a government of integrity, essentially, and it sends the wrong signals in that sense too. We therefore see a government which is drifting and failing to achieve some of its own specific targets. And that's got to be a worry for the Prime Minister and indeed for their election chances.
Speaking of Boris Johnson, he's been named by his supporters as a potential candidate to replace Nadeem Zahawi.
He's seen as a vote magnet, but he's also a trouble magnet. Most recently, we've seen these questions being asked about the chair of the BBC helping him out with a loan. Nothing has been said about law-breaking, but with all of the other problems the Conservatives have, do they really want to risk Boris Johnson in a position where he could bring more intrigue, let's say?
That, in addition to a parliamentary inquiry into whether Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons over Partygate, lockdown rule-breaking drinking sessions during the pandemic, and an investigation into numerous complaints of bullying by Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab. Nadeem Zahawi will be remembered as the minister who played fast and loose with the rules, and became the first one to be dismissed by the Prime Minister. But no one's sure if he will be the last. Saeed Pourrezep, London.
Now, thousands of Belgians have hit the streets of the capital, Brussels, to demand higher pay and better working conditions. The protest was organized by trade unions representing several public sector workers. A large part of the demonstrators were from the care sector, which was especially hard hit by the COVID pandemic. The workers also denounced heavy workload due to a staff shortage, demanding immediate action from the government. Belgium has been the scene of such protests in recent weeks amid rising energy and food prices there. Belgium, like other fellow EU members, is grappling with a cost of living crisis in the wake of the Ukraine war and the pandemic. The country's inflation rate currently stands at more than 10%. Britain saying it's not practical to send fighter jets to Ukraine, joining other NATO countries that are against supplying Kyiv with military aircraft. A spokesperson for the British Prime Minister says fighter jets are extremely sophisticated and take months to learn how to fly, making the aircraft a non-pragmatic option in the conflict. He said, however, that London will continue to discuss the issue with its allies. The U.S. and Germany already rejected the idea of supplying fighter jets. The French president previously said that he didn't rule out sending military aircraft to Kyiv. The Ukrainian president has recently urged his Western backers to supply long-range missiles and fighter jets to counter Russia. The West, the U.S. in particular, has supplied arms and munitions worth tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine since the beginning of the war last year. Palestinian prisoners languishing in an Israeli jail resumed their hunger strike for a second day. 120 detainees have been refusing food in protest against the inhumane situation of the prison in the Negev desert. Human rights groups have repeatedly expressed concerns over the treatment of Palestinians in Israeli detention centers. For years, locked-up Palestinians have had no choice other than going on hunger strike to raise awareness about the violation of their basic rights in jails. Most of the Palestinian inmates are held without charge or trial. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, joined us earlier with details on the hunger strike by Palestinian inmates in that Israeli jail.
120 Palestinian prisoners are continuing their hunger strike against the Israeli practices, the illegal, of course, practices against Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, and mainly for against the Israeli ongoing raids to the cells at any time, transferring Palestinian prisoners from a cell to another and even from jail to another, imposing solitary confinement against Palestinian prisoners. In addition to this, we have to mention that Palestinian prisoners from both the Hamas and Jihad movement had even refused to leave their cells today in a number of Israeli jails like Majiddo, Awfer, and Ad-Damun to protest the illegal Israeli practices against them. And also hundreds of Palestinian prisoners had refused to get their meals today. It's not a hunger strike, but they returned back their meals. It's, of course, a protest. It's a move seen by the Israelis as a challenge by the Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds have staged a rally against Israel's demolition drive as part of its expansionist agenda in the occupied lands. Protesters blocked roads with stones and set fire to dustbins in the Jabal Makaber neighborhood. They warned the regime against stealing their ancestral land. Tel Aviv has recently demolished a number of Palestinian homes and structures under different pretexts, including lack of construction permits. Palestinians and rights groups say that the demolitions are part of Israel's land-grab policy to expand settlements. All Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned the regime's settlement activity. Iran warning against any aggression in the country, vowing a decisive response that would make enemies regret their action. The warning follows an anti-Iran rhetoric by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. In an interview, the top U.S. diplomat rehashed allegations against Iran's nuclear program, saying that all options remain on the table to stop Iran acquiring an atomic weapon. Iranian Foreign Ministry says that the U.S. is well aware that Iran will not tolerate any aggression against its territory and interests. Spokesman Nazar Kanani urged U.S. authorities to beware of the legal, international, and political consequences of such provocative statements. He once again underlined the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, but added that the country won't stop its nuclear advances as a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran has hosted the first international conference that's called Media and the Unity of Islamic World. The event brought together thinkers, journalists, and activists from Islamic nations to explore avenues to boost unity among the Islamic community through media collaboration. Salman Kujuri was also there.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic Ummah kicked off in the capital Tehran on Sunday to discuss ways for the unity of the Islamic Ummah based on media activities. Media activists, managers, and journalists from different Islamic countries attended the first Minaret International Conference held by Iran's World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The unity of the Islamic Ummah, media truth and media literacy, and the capacity of international media were the three major axes which were discussed by the participants at the first Minaret International Conference in Tehran.
I have taken part in the first conference on media and Islamic unity because I believe the media play a key role in shedding light on the atrocities of the oppressive regimes like Israel against Palestinians. Islamic media can keep the path of resistance alive and inform more people of what is happening against Palestinians in the occupied lands.
Moreover, the participants in the event, in a statement, condemned the recent insults to the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in European countries.
In today's world, media outlets play an important role in creating a campaign against a nation, religion, or belief. Western media centers have become the centers for waging war against other countries. The recent sacrilegious moves in European countries against the Holy Quran originates from the same policy. The insulting move hurt the feelings of billions of Muslims and provoked hatred and discord.
The statement also condemned Western governments for planting the seeds of hatred and animosity and fanning the flames of violence in the world. It underscored that Muslims based on their religious beliefs never allow themselves to insult the sanctities of other faiths and that the followers of Islam hold all divine books and prophets in high respect.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic world is aimed at building capacity, network, and raising awareness among Islamic nations with regard to international development, especially anti-Islam currents, which will further forge unity among Muslims worldwide. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The death toll from a suicide bombing in northwestern Pakistan keeps rising, officials confirming at least 100 deaths. So far, the blast took place in a crowded mosque in Peshawar, in a highly fortified security compound. It also left scores injured. Many of the casualties were police officers who'd gathered there for noon prayers. Some are in critical condition. No group has officially claimed responsibility, but Pakistan officials say that a breakaway faction of the militant group Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, called Khorasani, has claimed responsibility. The TTP itself has denied any responsibility, though it has a stepped-up attack since withdrawing from a peace deal with the Islamabad government last year. Now, the Taliban government has issued a new decree that bans universities from enrolling women in the 2023 entrance exam. That follows an earlier order that banned women from education altogether. In time, Iran has said it's ready to provide any support for the education of Afghan women. Our correspondent, Abdullah Amirzadeh, has more.
In a new decree by the Ministry of Higher Education, the Taliban government ordered universities and private institutions in Afghanistan not to enroll women in the entrance exam of 2023. While this decree strengthens a December decree that totally banned women from education, women feel frustrated about their future educations.
When I first heard that we can't enroll for the entrance exam and saw the decree, I felt frustrated. I had high hopes for my future. I feel terrible about that.
I felt like my life had come to an end when I heard this. To be alive is not just to breathe. One must reach their dreams. I felt deeply sorry and not alive.
While the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, with 57 members of Muslim countries, has called the new decree disappointing, Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a press conference expressed his country's readiness to provide any kind of support to Afghanistan in order to restore women's education in the country. Iranian universities had already announced their readiness to hold online classes for the women of Afghanistan. The women in Afghanistan say such a cooperation could be useful.
Once again, we stress that banning girls and women of Afghanistan from education is an improper act and against Islamic teachings. Iran is ready to offer any kind of support needed to upgrade education and reopen schools for the women of Afghanistan, in coordination with the interim Afghan government.
Meantime, Afghan women say international community has turned a blind eye to their problems.
Unfortunately, whatever happens in Afghanistan, the international community just condemns it. Online education, on the other hand, is definitely positive, but not as much as face-to-face classes. We women ask the international community to negotiate with the Taliban on reopening the schools.
Education ban in Afghanistan started 500 days ago on girls in 7th to 12th grade, then a ban on universities 2 months ago, and following that, women were banned from working for foreign NGOs and organizations that caused many of these NGOs to stop their mission in Afghanistan. Now, a ban on entrance exam and the question, is there going to be more such restrictions?
In both decrees on women's education ban, a line draws attention saying, until further notice. But nobody really knows if and when this ban will end. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
In other news, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg saying that a military alliance wants to further boost partnership with Japan, that's a partner of NATO, in the Ukraine war.
We live in a more dangerous and more unpredictable world, and then we need strong partnerships between countries and alliances that believe in democracy and freedom, and Japan is one of our oldest and most capable partners, and therefore my visit here to Japan is a way to further strengthen the partnership between NATO and a highly valued partner, Japan.
Stoltenberg was speaking during a visit to an airbase near Tokyo. That's part of his trip to Northeast Asia to strengthen relations with U.S. allies and rally greater support for Ukraine against Russia. Japan is not a member of NATO, but it has stepped up cooperation with the military alliance amid the Ukraine war. The Asian country has provided Kiev with non-lethal military supplies and financial support to help the country counter Russia. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember in the previous episode, we discussed the events leading to the acceptance of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 598 by the Islamic Republic of Iran after Imam Khomeini's permission. The resolution had in fact included some conditions for a just ceasefire of the Iraq-Iran war. We said that Iran had not accepted the former resolutions due to neglecting Iran's rights and being far from realities on the ground. Today we are going to talk about the events before Imam Khomeini's passing away. Stay tuned, please. Nowruz of the new Iranian year 1368, March 1989, was a special event for the Iranian people as they were going to celebrate the first Nowruz after the end of the eight-year imposed war. Nowruz feast had coincided with the anniversaries of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, and Imam Sajjad, peace upon them. Hence, people had decorated the streets and alleys more than ever. According to the custom of every year, people were waiting to watch Imam Khomeini's live message on the new Iranian year. A few days earlier, the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting, IRIB, had suggested recording the Imam's message and broadcasting it as a live TV message. But Imam Khomeini didn't accept the suggestion, saying, "If I am alive, I will say the congratulation myself. But if I am not alive, this will be taken over by the next leader of the Leadership Council." The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, said on the issue after his passing away, "He would not accept even this much of dishonesty with people, so that the IRIB broadcast his pre-recorded message as live message." In those days, the Imam Khomeini's family was not that happy as the Imam was somehow ill. Lady Saghafi says, "I saw that the Imam had become weaker for a few days, and I noticed that he had gone to the clinic of Jamaran without informing me. I asked him, 'Why do you go to the clinic? What do they do with you?' He said, 'They take images from me.' I asked him, 'What has happened to you?' He said, 'My stomach was bleeding for a few days.' I was upset and told him, 'Why didn't you tell me anything?' He kept silent." Imam Khomeini's special physician, Dr. Arefi, heard of his illness, so he and his advisors started examining the Imam's stomach. Ms. Saghafi describes the issue. "Radiography began again And one day, it was clear that the imam had been under the apparatus for long. So, when he returned home, he was overtired. I realized that he had a tough time, because I had experienced the exam a few years before, and I knew how hard the exam was. So, in order not to upset the imam, I said, "Inshallah, it is nothing and you will get better soon." Yet, I knew that a simple stomachache and even temporary bleeding shouldn't urge doctors to do exams so many times. The imam didn't answer, and as it was the lunchtime, he ate a few spoons of the soup and went to his room to rest. The exams of physicians made them decide that Imam Khomeini had to undergo surgical operation. The imam's wife was opposed to operation because he was very weak and she was worried that he might not endure it. She continues, "I was informed of the imam's public health and said that there was no need for operation. I told Ahmad to ask the medical team to forget about surgery and told the imam, 'You are too weak and cannot endure surgery.' He said, 'What can I do when they all say that I should be operated?' Finally, the day after the exams, doctors got Imam Khomeini's permission to hospitalize and operate him. The imam was little satisfied to be operated, yet he surrendered to the view of physicians. Ms. Saghafi says, "That night, there was nobody at home except me and the imam. Ahmad Agha and his wife came before the dinner. They went before the dinner. I had no appetite to eat the dinner, and the imam ate just bread, yogurt, and cucumber. After the dinner, the brother, his daughter-in-law, Dr. Tabatabai, came. He was ready to accompany the imam to the hospital. I said, 'I entrust you to God.' The imam came out of his room and told me to lock the door and take its key." Imam Khomeini went to the hospital. Ms. Saghafi continues the story. "We had lived together for 60 years. We might be upset with each other at times, but the imam would tell me repeatedly, 'Be satisfied with me.' Imam Khomeini went so fast that I failed to reach him. I was near the door of the clinic when he went down the steps and bid me farewell. I told him goodbye and came back with Fatima. Imam Khomeini passed away 2 weeks after hospitalization. Every detail of the operation could be watched by the family as there were cameras at the operation section. They were praying sadly. The imam was under operation, but he didn't forget prayer and supplication. He didn't forget religious obligatory acts. Ms. Saghafi told him, 'I have come with you whenever you have gone, so take me to paradise with yourself.' He said with a smile, 'Thanks a lot for always being with me, but in the hereafter, everyone is alone with their deeds.'" Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, or you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected brothers, sisters, we've gathered here for the special occasion of celebrating the birthday of Imam Muhammad Al-Jawad Al-Taqi alayhi salam. On this occasion, I want to congratulate all of you, and especially the Imam of our time, Ajallahu Farajahu Sharif. May Allah reward you all for your participation, your commemoration, and may Allah Ta'ala accept these efforts and make us among the true followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad was the only child of Imam al-Ridha alayhi as-salam. Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, just like the other Imams, just like the other awliya of Allah, just like the Anbiya, the Prophets, was tested in different ways in his life. And one of the tests that he had to go through was that he did not have a child until late in his life. And this is something that is worth noting and worth remembering for all of us, that those people who are chosen by Allah, those people who are sincere in their devotion to Allah, are tried and tested in many different ways. This is part of the way that Allah deals with His closest of servants. And the same type of challenges that sometimes we feel have come and they overwhelm us, we can remember that those people that we look up to as our guides and our role models, they often face those same challenges. And by taking them as our example and looking at them and how they dealt with these challenges, that gives us inspiration. It gives us confidence that we too, with the help of Allah, can deal with these problems and overcome them. There's once a companion of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam who he goes to him and he sees him and he asks him that, is it possible for the imamah to be transferred to a brother? And the imam says that, no, not at this time. Is it possible to transfer to a nephew? No, not now. No, the imamah will not be transferred to a nephew. What about a daughter of the son of a sister, son of a brother? No. Because Imam Ridha alayhi salam had relatives. So then he asks him, he says that, so after you, who will be the imam? Who is it that's going to get the imama after you? That he says that there will be a son who's born to me. And that son will be such, يُفَرِّقُ بَيْنَ الْحَقِّ وَالْبَاطِلِ. That son will be somebody who separates between truth and falsehood. He will separate between the truth and the falsehood. This is one of the predictions that we have from the Imam. But we can tell from this hadith that the people were wondering. The Shias, some of them were worrying. As they saw the Imam alayhi salam advance in his years, they're thinking that how many years does the Imam have to live? What will happen and who will be the successor after him? There was once a person who wanted to go and meet the Imam, and he sought permission to enter into his company. His name was Ibn Qiyamah. He goes to Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam and he asks him straight up. He says, Hal anta imam? Are you an imam? Imagine the treatment that the imams alayhi salam used to face by some people who were very well acquainted with who they were. He was going to the son of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam and he's asking him, are you an imam? Imagine the type of boldness that he has. And Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam says that, yes, I am the imam. Imagine now the imam, that man, Ibn Qiyamah, he responds to him, he says that, wa ashhadu annaka lasta bi imamin. I bear witness that you are not an imam. How? What is this? And he says that, I myself heard from Ja'far ibn Muhammad, Imam Ja'far alayhi salam, I heard that an imam will never be without a child. And now you've gotten to be elderly in your age, and therefore you're not an imam. He tells him straight in his face. At this point, it's very interesting. We're told in hadith that Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam raises his hands in dua. And he begins to call upon Allah. And he says, "O Allah, I ask you," and the gist of the dua is, "I ask you to grant me a child who will be my inheritor. And يَمْلَأُ الْأَرْضَ عَدْلًا وَقِسْطًا قَمَا مُلِئَتْ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا." That he will spread justice in the earth just the same way that it was filled with injustice. This is a dua that Imam alayhi salam makes. And the person who narrates this tradition, he says that we counted and we saw that the birth of Imam Jawad alayhi salam was exactly the amount of time such that Allah would have granted that dua of Imam Amrada alayhi salam when he raised his hands to make it. I mean, that was one of the miracles of the Imam, that in face of this type of challenge that came from this person who should have known better, the Imam alayhi salam makes dua and the dua is answered. So Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam was a very special blessing that came to the home of Imam Ali al-Ridha alayhi salam, and that's whose birth we're celebrating tonight. Brothers and sisters, on this night, I don't want to lengthen the speech, but I just want to mention a couple of points about one of the things that we see in the life of Imam Jawad alayhi salam that inshallah we can take and practically apply in our lives. You see that from a very young age, Imam Jawad alayhi salam had a very firm understanding of justice and injustice. He had a firm stance against the oppressor of the time. Even though he was a child, he was aware of this and he spoke out fearlessly against this. And we see this throughout the life of Imam Jawad alayhi salam, that he was somebody who always spoke for the truth. He always understood this is haq and this is batil. This is truth and this is falsehood. One of the things I came across when I was studying his life was the qunut of the Imam alayhi salam. Imam would make in his prayers, in his du'as. It's very interesting to see what would the Imams pray for in their qunut. And you know, sometimes we get in a habit of reciting like one qunut or another dua in qunut. For example, we say, رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَا وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَا وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ, which is great, alhamdulillah, it's a beautiful dua. رَبِّي زِدْنِي عَلْمًا وَالْحِقْنِي بِالصَّانِينَ, great. رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لِي وَلِوَالِدَيَا, great. But if you look at the seerah of the imams and even look at the seerah of the great scholars, like their example, what they would do is they would make use of their qunut to pray to Allah concerning situations that they were occurring to them at the time. They made their du'as relevant to what was going on. And one of the great things that we can do is become familiar with the types of du'as that we can make for different situations. For example, I'm worried about my children, so I can make this du'a. What is that du'a I can make, for example? I'm worried about some bala that's come my way. What dua can I make at that point? I'm feeling fearful. What dua can I make to in my qunut to give peace to my heart? And so on and so forth. So what the Imam alayhi salam would do is, because of the political situation at the time, he would make dua. And in that dua, he would clearly make dua for justice. And he would pray against the oppressors. For example, in one dua, he would say, Allahumma adli li awliya'ika min aduwik, min a'da'ika al-zalimin. Oh Allah, help your close ones and your friends against the enemies who are oppressors. What do they do? Adallu ibadaka wa harrafu kitabak. They misguide your servants. They have changed your book. فَضَلُّوا وَأَضَلُّوا خَلْقَكَ. They're misguided and then they misguide others as well. Imam alayhi salam is clearly laying out the line. And then he says, وَحَتَكُوا حِجَابَ سِرِّكَ عَنْ عِبَادِكَ. And then he says that they have taken away the sanctity. They have occupied the positions of those who should be in that position, meaning the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And he would make these type of du'as. Of course, he's seeking help from Allah, but also to teach the people that this is something that we can't be quiet about. This is something that is very important. It's essential to our identity as followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, to be very clear on that.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The new Zionist regime's government has started a new wave of violent attacks against Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. Also, Zionist settlers, encouraged by the far-right Zionist government of Netanyahu, have intensified their attacks against innocent Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, living up to their murderous nature, Zionist occupiers massacred in cold blood 10 Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp on January 26th. Among those shot and killed was a 60-year-old Palestinian grandmother, Magda Obeid. She was shot in the neck. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Sa'eb Esam Mahmoud is Regi, 24, and Ezzedin Yassin Salaha, 26, were also killed in the early morning of the Zionist regime's assault on Jenin. Another 20 Palestinians were wounded. Four of them were reported to be in critical condition. The Zionist assault on the refugee camp was carried out using a ruse. Heavily armed troops entered the camp riding in a commercial truck to hide their identity. As they entered the camp, the Zionists opened fire on residents who realized what was going on and attempted to block their entry. Several other army vehicles, including bulldozers, followed the commercial vehicle and attacked a building used as a meeting place for residents. Quoting Anas Hawaisha, a Palestinian correspondent at a local channel in Jenin, the Middle East Eye reported, "The sounds of bullets and gunfights were intense and clouds of smoke covered the sky. The Israeli occupation cut off the electricity, the internet and the cell phone network during the storming. This shows that it was planned." The Zionists entered Jenin near the area of Jorat al-Hab. When the Palestinians discovered that the Israelis were attacking, they sounded the alarm to alert their residents of the camp. There was an exchange of fire between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli troops, and then more forces were pushed into the camp, Hawaisha said, adding, "Tens of military vehicles laid a siege around the area." True to their lying nature, the Zionists claimed they were targeting fighters who, according to their intelligence reports, were planning attacks. The Zionist occupiers have seldom needed any excuse to murder innocent Palestinians. After all, at least 29 Palestinians have already been murdered this month. This murder rate surpasses even the horrendously high figures for 2022, when more than 250 Palestinians were murdered by the occupation forces. And why did the occupiers prevent Red Crescent medical workers from evacuating the wounded by restricting access to the refugee camp? Palestinian Health Minister Mai Al-Kaleh said that the Israeli regime forces stormed Jenin government hospital and intentionally fired tear gas canisters at the pediatric department in the hospital. Video footage showed Israeli regime fire tear gas choking women and children inside the pediatric department. Were these women and children also planning to attack the Zionist murderers? Ever since the new fascist cabinet has taken charge, led by the indicted criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, attacks on Palestinians have escalated. Such notorious terrorists as Itamar Ben-Gvir, Bezalel Smotrich, Avi Moz, and Yariv Levin in the Israeli regime cabinet have vowed to kill more Palestinians. Zionist criminals establish their credentials by killing and maiming Palestinians. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported hardcore Israeli settler fanatics on January 29th set on fire a house and parked a vehicle after sneaking into the town of Tormuz Aya to the northeast of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, according to local sources. Awad Abu Samra, a resident of the town, told Wafa that a group of settlers backed by army militias sneaked into the town in the middle of the night before they set a parked vehicle on fire, completely destroying it and setting fire to the house of Mr. Odeh Jabara, a local Palestinian resident, causing partial damage to the external walls of the house. Meantime, groups of Zionist settlers stormed the nearby village of Duma and shattered at least one vehicle. The settlers also shattered the windows of a house in the village. These attacks are part of an ongoing wave of unabated settler violence encouraged by the new far-right Israeli regime government of Netanyahu and with incitement from his ultra-nationalist cabinet ministers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Also, Wafa reported Israeli regime forces stole artifacts from the village of Sebastia, north of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, Local sources said Muhammad Azam, head of the Sebastia municipality, said that the Zionist regime forces stole artifacts from the archaeological sites in the village. He added that the forces have been surrounding staff from the municipality and the Ministry of Tourism for hours.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. Mothers are a foundation for transferring the elements of national identity. National identity is something important. This is about the identity of a nation and a nation's character. This is primarily transferred by mothers. Things such as language, habits, manners, traditions, good morals, and good habits. All of these are primarily passed on by mothers. Fathers are also influential, but much less so than mothers. A mother has the greatest impact. She's the one who sprinkles the seeds of faith in hearts. It is mothers who raise children to be believers. Faith is not a subject to be taught or learned. Faith is something that grows. It is a spiritual growth that must be planted. It is the mothers who plant the seeds for it. The same goes for ethics. So a mother plays quiet an extraordinary role. Now these two roles are important. I have said this many times already and it is something that I believe. These things are the main most important duties of a woman. ¶¶
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the women here announced that she is a housewife. Well, that's very good. According to Islam, the main role of a woman is her role as a housewife. However, what's important is that being a housewife does not mean staying at home all the time. Some people make a mistake about this. When we say housewife, they think we mean that you should sit at home and do nothing, that you have no duties, you should not teach, you should not struggle on the path of God. And that you should not get involved in social work or political activities. That is not what being a housewife means. Being a housewife means taking care of your home, and alongside that, you can do any other work that you are able to manage, you are interested in doing, and you are enthusiastic about. However, all of these come after being a housewife. If you are caught in a situation where you have to choose between saving a child's life and working in an office, the child's life comes first. Do you have any doubts about this? No. No woman has any doubt that a child's life comes first.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.